This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
Not only was Friday Valentine's Day, but it was also the first official day that the Phase 1 trade deal went into effect. Tariffs on both sides of the agreement officially began coming down. The coronavirus outbreak is causing concern about China meeting its obligation under the agreement, however. An AgriPulse report says U.S. experts are worried about whether ports, interior transportation, and soybean crushers are all operating at normal levels. However, industry sources and USDA data show that 1.6 million metric tons of U.S. beans were making their way across the Pacific heading for China. The latest numbers show that 69,000 tons of beans left in the U.S. and headed to China during the week of January 31st. During that same time frame, USDA reports showed net sales of 132,000 tons of beans to China for 2019-2020's marketing year. The numbers show that soybeans are still going to China, even though information coming out of China is almost non-existent. Officials point out that we still don't know any specifics about how many purchases China will make under the Phase 1 agreement. Farm groups are looking for more specific information, but don't have any just yet. And while much of the attention on the deal between the U.S. and China centers around the concerns of China meeting its purchasing requirements under the agreement, there are some deadlines it has to meet. There are some deadlines for U.S. to meet as well. Politico said Friday that within the next seven business days, the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service and China's Customs Agency are all required to sign a protocol to allow for the importation of U.S. potatoes. China is also required by February 24th to formally recognize the U.S. dairy safety system is safe as its own, as well as allowing imports of American pork that's been inspected by the USDA's Food and Safety and Inspection Service. China is also required by March 14th to lift its ban on U.S. pet food containing ruminant ingredients and to eliminate cattle age requirements on U.S. import of beef and beef products. The two sides are also required that by the same date to begin technical discussions intended to pave their way for China to import U.S. breeding cattle. In other trade news from around the world, in a bid to land a limited trade pact with the U.S., Reuters says that India has offered to partially open up its poultry and dairy market. The offer comes as India readies for President Trump's first official visit to the country at the end of February. No country produces more milk than India, which has traditionally restricted dairy imports to protect the livelihoods of 80 million households involved in the industry. Last year, Trump suspended India's special trade designation that dates back to the 70s. That move came after India put price caps on medical devices such as cardiac stents and knee implants, as well as introduced new data localization requirements and e-commerce restrictions. The U.S. is India's second-largest trading partner, trailing only to China. India has offered to allow imports of U.S. chicken legs, turkey, and produce like blueberries and cherries, while also cutting tariffs on chicken legs from 100% down to 25%. U.S. negotiators would like to cut that to 10%. The Indian government is also allowing some access to its dairy market, but with a 5% tariff and quotas. However, dairy imports would need a certificate saying they aren't derived from animals that have consumed feeds containing internal organs, blood, meal, or tissues of ruminants. In other ag news, to our friends north of us in Canada, 3 months after a week-long strike back in November, the Canadian National Railway again is being disrupted. Dennis Guy has more from Canada.
This time, Native Indigenous protesters are blockading CN Rail across the country, with primary blockades in and around Native lands in British Columbia, Manitoba, and Southern Ontario. CN operates the main Canadian rail line running east and west, a vital carrier for goods, especially in winter months. The rail line is also the main Western farm commodities carrier to coastal ports for export. Todd Hames, chairman of Alberta's Grain Commission, said farmers across Canada are once again being threatened by rail service disruption.
We export roughly just over 80% of our product, so export is our livelihood. If we can't get our product to port, we don't get paid, we can't make a living, so it's becoming dire again.
Brent Mullen, president of Alberta Pork, says that because Canada's ag industry is so export-oriented, whether it's another railway disruption, a trade issue, or a social issue, Canadian farmers seem to take a hit.
So no matter what anybody's problem is, no matter what the trade issue, no matter what the disease that might arrive anywhere, the farmer in our country pretty much pays the burden for it.
The issue is complex, but it revolves around Wet'suwet'en sovereignty in central western British Columbia and a coastal gas-link pipeline project across Wet'suwet'en territory. Wet'suwet'en territory was never ceded to the Government of Canada, and no land treaty was ever established. Hereditary chiefs say the decision to approve a pipeline in their ancestral lands without consent is an infringement of their Aboriginal title and rights. Those rights are protected under Canada's Constitution. Ironically, elected chiefs and band councils from about 20 individual First Nations, including the Wet'suwet'en, have signed agreements consenting to the project. But the hereditary chiefs have gained support from some tribe members over elected band council agreements. The RCMP began moving into Wet'suwet'en territory late last week, arresting some lead protesters. Now, groups in various provinces are blockading CN rail lines in solidarity with grassroots Wet'suwet'en protesters. Perry Belgrade is the national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. He says what's happening on Wet'suwet'en territory is highlighting the difference between First Nation law and Canadian law.
It's not Wet'suwet'en law that's being recognized and followed. And that's the issue here. You've got the Indian Act chiefs that have jurisdiction on the reserve lands, and they've done their due diligence. But in the ancestral territory lands of the Wet'suwet'en people, it's hereditary chiefs and their clans and their big houses that have the jurisdiction. There's this thing called the Indian Act that put the two-year elective system in place. That's what we have to move beyond. You're not going to achieve reconciliation when you criminalize political activism.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
And now moving on into Midwest Ag News here on your Monday morning. States that border the Missouri River are forecast to experience an elevated flood risk this spring again. The National Weather Service says those conditions will only be made worse by already saturated soil and a lot of snow melt. The National Weather Service issued its first spring flood outlook last week, saying Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and eastern North and South Dakota all face an above-average flooding risk. It's not good news, as many of those areas are still trying to recover from devastating flooding last year that damaged levees and cost farmers millions in crop loss. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says they are very concerned at this point. An Associated Press report says even places where the Corps was able to patch holes in some levees, the normal levee protection won't be there because of initial repairs that have not yet been done to the full height of the levee. Officials say levee repairs will likely take up to 2 years to complete. Parts of the challenge is the water remains so high in some areas that officials couldn't even assess the full scope of damage until just recent. Many levees in Iowa and Nebraska have been patched, but work has not yet begun in Kansas or Missouri. And much of the major risk of flooding is along the Mississippi River as well. That's the headline from the spring flood outlook from the National Weather Service in the Quad Cities, says meteorologist Andy Irvin.
We are dealing statistically with a very high risk for flooding. We're talking in excess of 95% chance of reaching flood stage, even moderate flooding, and about a 95% chance of reaching major flooding. So those are about as high as percentages as are possible. Given the fact that it's not currently occurring, which would, of course, be 100%. To that respect, we have several things that we're looking at that bring the flooding concern. And a lot of those situations really haven't changed much from last fall. We're dealing with a high soil moisture content across the entire upper Midwest. We've got plenty of snow upstream on the Mississippi. And the current stages on the Mississippi, while not flooding, are already fairly high compared to normal. So depending on how the snow melt occurs and how much rainfall occurs, with that overall setup of already wet soils and a lot of water in our system already would determine the severity of our flooding. And those are the details that we don't know specifics on at this time, but the overall probabilities of us reaching minor, moderate, and major flooding are extremely high.
The National Weather Service Quad Cities Office flood outlook is for the Mississippi River, where it borders Iowa, from Dubuque to near Keokuk. Finally, in the local ag news, Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville announced on Friday that 8 counties in the 13th Congressional District will be beneficiaries of $7.3 million in FCC grants to expand rural broadband. The funding will go towards connecting unserved homes and businesses. A list by county with the amount received and the number of homes and businesses served are as follows. Bond County will receive $206,000 that will serve 21 farms and other households. Calhoun County, $825,000 to 914 different households. Greene County, $746,000 to 222 different households. Jersey County, $762,000 to 176 different households. Macoupin County will receive $3.5 million that will serve 630 different households. Madison County, $334,000 for 175 different places. Montgomery County, $918,000 that will serve 107 households here in Montgomery County. And Sangamon County, $32,000 to serve 7 different households. And that'll wrap up today's Ag News on a Monday morning. But remember, if you have any Ag News for us, you can email that to us at WSMI@WSMIRadio.com. Also remember, no grain markets today in observance of President's Day. So for this Monday morning, February 17th, this has been Gabe Osborne reporting for WSMI Ag News.